Good morning. Welcome to our roundtable. On the roundtable, we have a wonderful panel and lots of good stuff to talk about this morning. Joining me for the discussion, WAMC's Alan Chartok, our news director, Ian Pickus, and Stephen Gottlieb, the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor at Albany Law School, as well as a WAMC commentator. Stephen, a delight to have you aboard. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here.
As evidenced by the fact that we have Stephen here, many of our, if not all of our topics are very court heavy. So we're going to tap into your expertise here this morning and talk about a lot of stuff. We, of course, welcome you to join in on the conversation roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or by tweeting us WAMC at WAMC Roundtable, at WAMC Roundtable. So good morning, all. How are you?
Hey,
good morning.
Wonderful. Excellent. We are going to talk about the obvious top story of the day, which, of course, is the Supreme Court returning to the subject of same-sex marriage for a second day on Wednesday when the justices hear argument about the constitutionality of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act of 1996. While Tuesday's case about California's ban on same-sex marriage has the potential to establish a constitutional right for gay and lesbian couples to marry, Wednesday's case is comparatively modest. It asks whether married same-sex couples are entitled to federal benefits. We are going to kind of parse this and look at issue one, of course, which is what happened yesterday. And Stephen, what do you make out of what happened before the court yesterday throughout the day?
Well, it left me wondering why they took the case. And which side took the case, whether it was the liberals or the conservatives? These guys can see around the corner, so to speak, and they can make history. And there's so much time given, seeming to be driven by Chief Justice Roberts, to reasons to get rid of the cases, that one wonders if somebody has changed side in the background. But it looked to me, given where Kennedy was, he's not backing up on his principles. He's concerned about the families, the children, and so forth. So I think their problem is they don't know how to make a small judgment that only applies to California or New York or even just a couple of states. These are big cases with issues that don't cabin very easily.
You know, first of all, nobody is second to me in my respect for Professor Gottlieb. You are terrific, and I'm so glad you're with us today. But I have to tell you, I think you're right. Legalistically, is one thing, but politically, I think things are changing so fast, these guys don't know what to do. And I think you're right. I think probably the guys who were against it probably wanted to take it and shoot it down.
Mm-hmm.
But now they see, even Bill Clinton, who basically signed the act in the first place, says, no, no, it's bad. Hillary Clinton says, no, no, it's bad. State legislatures all around the country are saying, we want gay marriage. We want to have this equal opportunity here. So I think that the politics have gone so fast that a lot of these guys are left with their thumbs up in the air.
So they could be pulled kicking and screaming to the birth of a new constitutional right.
On the other hand, yeah. Tell us about Professor and
David
Justice
Cole?
Ginsburg, who is very interesting in her talk about how Roe turned out to be a bad idea, she thought, because they went too fast.
There is in fact a fair amount of evidence, without taking a position on it, that Roe set back the cause of abortion rights rather than advancing it, because there was a trajectory that was leading up to Roe, and that trajectory levels and stops, and starts going backwards after Roe.
What do you mean?
A trajectory of states, increasing number of states that were authorizing abortions. By the time that Roe was decided. And this is Gerald Rosenberg's book of about a decade or so ago called The Hollow Hope. He did some things in that book that I vastly disagree with. He argued that Brown didn't make a difference, and I think that's nuts. And I'm in print on that.
I was just going to bring Brown up because there's a good example. It was resisted. Many states in the South hated it. They didn't want it. And yet, it is now really not only the law of the land, but is really it really has taken effect.
Well, I think that's right. And Brown had an immense group of people who were working to enforce it and who were not going to let it up. But Roe is a different situation, and I don't think there's anything in the abortion controversy that's going to be duplicated in the gay rights controversy, because you had those graphics, you have now the heartbeat. There's nothing like that in the gay rights controversy that I can see on the horizon. And if that's the case, then Roe is the wrong fear example for what's going to happen here. But David Cole brought it up in the Times yesterday.
Right. Yeah, we talked about that yesterday. And I do want to talk. We're going to be talking more about the issue of abortion and certainly what happened in North Dakota later on in our discussion this morning. When you look at what was decided, I mean, I think, and you've been obviously doing this for a long time, can you really figure anything out from sort of deciphering, looking at the transcript?
Oh, yeah. And I was thinking last night as I took the transcript home that maybe I should have just done the podcast because there's a different. But I'm so much a print guy.
But we finally did this. I love the idea that we can now, for the first time, several years now, but hear what these guys are and these women are thinking.
Yes. It's still weird hearing it on the radio. I heard it on the
But it's so much so different,
night.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I really
like
have a feeling these are individuals. These are people.
That's
and not
right.
just Nina Totenberg's you know, interpretation of the way they sounded.
Although sometimes I really need Nina because I don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Exactly.
I think she's excellent.
Yeah.
And she gets so quickly to that crucial soundbite of what the justices said. To answer the question, it's typically said that you don't know which way a justice or a judge is going. But yeah, you can tell. This court has gotten so politicized that I think that comment has outlived its usefulness. Because you usually can tell which way they are driving, even if they will decide on the basis of a different argument. I think it's clear, for example, that Scalia wants this case and wants to make a decision. He was very dismissive of the arguments that it's improperly in front of the court. On the merits, on what we should do about gay rights, I think they lined up pretty much the way you would have expected.
Mm-hmm. But you know, we were all wrong trying to read the tea leaves on the Obamacare decision and found out in June just how wrong we were a few months earlier. So I wonder, you know, when this decision comes down, will there be that moment where you look back at a pivotal question or something in the transcript and say, well, maybe there was a hint here the way we did, you know, last summer.
Mm. But Ian, you know, you're so on target with this business because Roberts had something else in mind here. I don't think he liked Obamacare. We all know that. He just was worried about the court.
Yeah.
He was worried about the prestige of the court. And if they had done this, they were already considered, they already threw away an election. We know it. They stole an election. I'm so sorry to have to say it that way, but they did. Mm-hmm. You know, they were on the ropes to some degree. And I think he thought it would have been a disaster, a real constitutional crisis, not to go that way.
Isn't that true with any major decision, though?
No, I don't think so. Not any major decision.
They don't all get that kind of press.
No. And really, this was holy war.
Yeah.
One other thing you said before, which is there's no, what's this parallelism between abortion and the gay rights thing? And the common denominator is religion.
Sure.
I mean, you know, here you have a group of people who are going to say, quote Leviticus ad nauseum, you know, and say, my God told me not to do this and not to allow anybody else to do it either. And therefore, God is speaking to me in the same way God is speaking to me on abortion.
But a lot of the religious groups, I think, are breaking up over that issue.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And,
no,
and but, so but, even within the faiths, that issue seems to be changing. So they don't quite have the way of reaching out to the rest of the public. I mean, the fundamentalist portion of the public is powerful, but they're not a majority of the public.
And if you poll the number of people in the religion on something like abortion and some of the others, you won't get what the hierarchy is saying.
Right.
When we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this issue, more obviously about the court. We welcome your thoughts as well. You can email us roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or by tweeting us at WAMC Roundtable. Our discussion will continue after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable on the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Ian Pickus is here.
Good morning.
Alan Chartok is here.
Hi.
Hey. And Stephen Gottlieb from Albany Law School is here as well.
Good morning.
It's a great pleasure to have Professor Gottlieb with us. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. We, as I mentioned at the beginning of the last segment, we talked a lot about what happened yesterday in the court. Let's talk a little bit about today, and specifically the Federal Defense of Marriage Act of 1996. This has, as I mentioned, you know, modest in comparison. Married same-sex couples, are they entitled to federal benefits? So two questions, one being how much are these, in when it comes to the court, incredibly separate issues and very defined separate issues, or are they going to bleed into one another? Because they certainly have in the press coverage, number one. And then number two, what can we expect today as evidenced by anything that we heard yesterday?
Well, they do bleed into each other. And they bleed in because of principles that are sort of underneath and get affected both the due process and the equal protection arguments. The equal protection argument, you may remember, was the one that O'Connor raised in Lawrence versus Texas, and she preferred that way of going at things than the due process approach that that Kennedy took. And they each argued about which view was going to have the more more impact. But this case today is being argued on the Equal Protection Clause about the comparison between those people who are involved in a same-sex marriage and the treatment of those people who are involved in a opposite sex.
Now, Steve,
marriage.
I think there are some people out there who just don't know the Equal Protection Clause, and we've always considered it our jobs to make this an even playing field. So could you just describe what the Equal Protection Clause is?
Well, the Equal Protection Clause was adopted in the 14th Amendment, and it says that no state, and of course this is about the federal government, so there's an issue to explain, no state can deny to any person the equal protection of the laws, and that's what we're talking about, that clause. But we're also not talking about that clause because it doesn't apply to the federal government. It's very clear that it was applied, and it says it applies to the states. But the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, when it decided Brown, said on the same day, in the same group of decisions, it would be unthinkable to say that the states could not have segregated schools, but the federal government could. And so on that same day, it said that the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment, which clearly applies to the federal government, includes an equal protection component. There were views about equality at the time, of course, of the Bill of Rights, but they couldn't be put into the Constitution because of the struggle over slavery. Now they come to fruition in the Fifth Amendment, but we understand the Fifth Amendment on equality grounds in the same way that we understand the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So then the question here becomes, can the federal government treat gay marriage or same-sex marriage, which is legal in a state, a marriage that's legal in a state, differently from a different marriage that's also legal in the state? Since in New York, Windsor's marriage is a legal marriage. She is a married woman for New York purposes, for New York tax purposes, for all purposes, or was, she's a widow now, for all purposes in New York State, and it's the federal government that normally has nothing to do with marriage that is saying, no, 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 we'll treat you differently. So one of the things that I could see, if I'm not running on too long.
No, it's great. Great stuff.
One of the things that I could see is a federalism component helping to get the court out of this problem. I generally don't think that they really care about federalism.
Okay, so you have to take one more step back.
Sure.
And explain to everybody about two concepts. One of them is dual sovereignty, and the other is what you, and the kissing cousin is federalism. Because there's some people out there who won't know. Believe me, I teach this stuff, and I know they won't know what you mean when you talk about federalism.
Okay. Federalism is not a term in the Constitution. So you have all these people like Scalia saying, all we should do is read the words and do what the words say. And there's no word federalism in the Constitution. I don't even think the word federal is in the Constitution itself. But these justices want to create, for many purposes, they want us to believe that the states are sovereign over certain things that the federal government should not be able to touch. I think of that argument as an argument in favor of slavery, going back to the beginning, because as historians of the period have shown, what the people really did in 1787 was they took sovereignty back to themselves. They didn't create sovereign states. But this court likes what it can do with sovereignty of the states in saying, federal government, you stay out of this. This belongs to the states.
When it's convenient.
When it's convenient. That's exactly my point. Yeah. They only do it when it's convenient for their ideology about conservatism, about law, and so forth. So in this area, I don't think any of us really thought of the federal government as regulating marriage in any sense. Mm. There is a clause in the Constitution which gives the Congress the power to say what the effects of judgments and laws of one state will be in another. That's in Article 4. To say, here we are in this state and we'll recognize these marriages, but we won't recognize those marriages, that's not about the full faith and credit of the laws and decisions of other states. That's about just New York, how we'll treat New York or another state that has a similar view about marriage. So the court could, on the cases being argued today, take a real interest in federalism and say, what is this particular piece of DOMA doing there? I mean, it's one thing for DOMA to say that
defense of marriage, if you're just joining us from Mars. Yes.
Thank you, Ellen. Yeah. you could help me teach some of my classes, believe me. But it's one thing for the Defense of Marriage Act to say that New Jersey or some other state doesn't have to recognize what New York did. But it's another thing for the Defense of Marriage Act to say the federal government gets to treat some of what New York thinks as legal as if it doesn't exist. So I think the court could go there. I don't know if it's going to go there, but I would be exploring that out if I were in the position of the conservative justices.
We're going to take a quick break. We will be back to our conversation. Professor Stephen Gottlieb from Albany Law School joins us this morning. Alan Shartok is here as well, as is Ian Pickus. We welcome your input as well. You can email us, roundtable@wamc.org, or check us out on Facebook or Twitter. WAMC.org is the webpage. We would love to hear from you, as I stated. We'll be back with this conversation after a short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue with Alan Shartok, Ian Pickus, and Professor Stephen Gottlieb from Albany Law School. We're talking about a lot of court stuff today because there's a lot of court stuff in the news, and we've been talking mostly for the first part of our discussion about the court's action and the court's hearing of same-sex marriage cases. The other case that has been obviously making news earlier this week, on Monday, the Supreme Court decided to take a second case concerning affirmative action in university admissions, agreeing to review a lower court's decision that said Michigan's ban on the use of race in college acceptance decisions was unconstitutional. And as I said, this is a second case. So what do we make of that, Stephen?
The court seems to want to make it clear, I think, on this one, because I'm sure that the decision to go cert on that was probably from the conservative justices.
Cert meaning that people could take the case.
That's right. I'm guessing that it's the conservative group on the court that wanted that case to strike down, not to strike down, but to reverse the lower court striking down that provision in the or amendment to the Michigan Constitution. By the way, I don't know if you realize it, but about two-thirds to three-quarters of the time, the court overrules the lower court. It reverses the lower court. So that can be a hint as to what's going on and what the court wants to do. It takes four votes to get the case there. And so I think in this point, on this issue, they're turning out to be very insistent about getting any reference to race whatsoever out of the capabilities of any public institution.
And now O'Connor's not there anymore.
That's
you were
right.
mentioning Lawrence v. Texas from 10 years ago, and things have changed as far as the conservative side of the court goes.
That's absolutely right. O'Connor was the one who said that one of the two school plans in the Michigan case was okay, that the way the law school did it, of course, the law school is much smaller than the university. So the university was doing it with numbers, and the law school was doing it with a kind of an individualized consideration.
Doing it meaning accepting
trying to get a certain trying to get some blacks into the class. And beyond some sort of critical mass so that they didn't feel totally alone when they got there, and so that it would have an impact on everybody's education. You know, I watch what happens in my class where, without speaking about any particular year or whatever, I'll have a lone black student in the class, and that doesn't do anything because that black student keeps his or her mouth shut.
Mm-hmm.
And I can read their expressions, but they're not contributing to the discussion when we get to race. But when we have a number, that changes completely what they're willing to say and the experiences that they're willing to share. That was the position of the law school in Michigan, and O'Connor favored that or supported that. It was also major corporations and the Army supported the notion that they needed graduates who were minority students. And again, it looked very much like O'Connor was sympathetic to that need. It wasn't we need leaders from all of our cultures, and that's a part of what's important to create.
And so what are the other side saying? In other words, what's the conservative side on this thing that if we start taking people who are black, white students will be deprived of seats, for example? You'll hear that. So therefore, I mean, this is not an argument I'm in favor of, but I'm just always like to know what the other guys are saying.
Well, they're saying things about colorblindness and the Constitution and Brown outlaw taking color into account. I don't frankly credit that as why they're doing things, because we all know and that you can do things in a way that doesn't mention color or religion or whatever else you want to deal with, and you can make it impossible for a particular group to get a job or whatever.
Yes, but these guys always, Stephen, always look for a rational excuse to do what maybe
that's right.
The left side of their brain is telling them.
They're looking for a rationalization to allow places to exclude whoever they don't particularly care about.
Sure.
And that's clearly the way that I read them. I don't quite read Kennedy that way. I think Kennedy sort of has shown signs of being a little bit more caring about that, but that's that was with O'Connor there.
But they always say about Kennedy that he's a, quote, libertarian.
Yes.
What does that mean in this case?
I'm not sure it tracks very well onto the race issue at all. Do you think it does?
It might. It might in that keep your hands off, you know, people in general. Don't say you have to do this or you don't have to do that. But on the other hand, he almost always tracks with the conservatives.
Right. So. And he's been very conservative on the race issue. But on the other hand, Kennedy was the one who broke a very long-standing pattern on the Rehnquist and Roberts courts, in which they never had found that racial discrimination had taken place. In other words, if a lower court said that there was racial discrimination, they might go along with that and say, what were the consequences of it? But in a murder case coming out of Texas, there was a lot of evidence of racial discrimination that the lower courts had not paid attention to. And therefore, this guy was going to swing. I don't, right at the moment, I'm not remembering people's names. And clearly the conservatives, other than Kennedy, wanted the guy to swing, and they didn't want to pay any attention to things like the district attorney having a book on how to exclude blacks from the jury. And Kennedy said, that's nonsense.
Swing here means execute. When you say you wanted the guy to swing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't want him to swing. No.
That's the law school term.
Yeah, the law school term.
Oh, right. Very technical. I was trying to be very ordinary language. But so he was the first one who was willing to say there's really been discrimination here. And he split from the rest of them. So I have to credit that Kennedy feels something of the pull of the unfairness that we've been inflicting on African Americans.
Who appointed Kennedy?
Reagan.
Ah.
Remember, Reagan initially appointed or nominated one of my law school professors, Robert Bork.
Indeed. Who could forget that?
And Bork didn't make it.
Bork got borked.
And that's right.
It became a verb.
And then Reagan nominated the man who wrote a course book on broadcasting, which you may remember, that was the book I was using when Dave Gilletly came and audited my course in the early 80s. And I loved that book. And then, well, he didn't get borked. He got smoked.
Yeah.
And who was that?
Ginsburg.
Yeah.
Who was a judge on the D.C. Circuit by that time, but he'd been at Harvard. To clarify my technical legal language, he had been found to smoke marijuana at a party at some time. So his
name, in college.
Gee, imagine that.
Terrible.
I won't tell you what I ever did with Alice B. Toklas brownies, but I didn't know what was in them. Then Reagan went to Justice Kennedy. And Kennedy was finally so that appointment took quite a long time between those three nominations before Kennedy was finally appointed. That was Reagan's last appointment.
So let me ask you very quickly:
questions are always fast. The answers aren't.
How important is the personality or character of the judge? I've just recently gone through some criticism from a very good friend of mine who is a judge, who, when I said, well, you know, there are liberals on the court, their basic orientation, and he said, no, it's always the law. And I just wondered if you want to check in on that.
Oh, I'll be happy to. I wrote a whole book about that.
Yeah.
Frankly, I think it's impossible to judge on this kind of a case without your philosophy coming into play. I mean,
how about your character? In other words, Freud said you have a character. By four, it's over. That's going to be your character. So your character orientation. We know there's lots of books written on the presidency for this. And
you mean whether you're honest or dishonest?
No, what you basically, do you like women? Don't you like women? You know this kind of stuff. So in other words, there are parts of one's character that then get rationalized in terms of looking for the right place, as you said before, in the law to support what you intuitively want.
Well, I guess I'm calling philosophy a piece of what you're calling character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because that piece that's ingrained in you is often particularly difficult to even realize that it's there. Sometimes it's so natural if it goes back that far.
So, for example, if you're a racist and you're a Supreme Court judge. You're shaking your head. What does that
well,
mean?
Well, I'm thinking of some examples yeah. of particular people that I obviously won't name or tell you anything about where I've encountered them. But
that's why we have commercial breaks or underwriting breaks.
where people are obviously being racist and don't know it.
Or do know it.
Well, in some cases, they don't.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I get it.
Or I think they don't believe they are. Now, I don't. I've met Scalia very briefly at a cocktail party, but I don't know the justices personally, so I can't respond in some sense as if.
But you wrote a whole book on Rehnquist, right?
Well, I wrote a book on the court.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And.
Well,
this guy put sergeant stripes on his sleeves
right.
when he was.
Well, you know, my point was Rehnquist and Scalia came onto the court railing against the Warren Court because the Warren Court put their philosophy into the judgments. And it really was very easy to show that the Rehnquist Court was doing exactly the same thing. Now, my point wasn't, oh, isn't it terrible that you're putting your philosophy into the court? Because on cases like the court has had to take, once the statute, the certiorari statute, gave the court control over which cases it takes. That goes back to the 20s. Once that happened, you were going to get an enormous percentage of cases in which they couldn't decide the cases without their philosophy affecting their judgment. So my point then became, well, do you really want Rehnquist's philosophy as opposed to Warren's philosophy? I mean, which can we live with? And that was really my point.
We're going to take a quick break. We will continue, and I want to talk about the case in North Dakota, about abortion, and, of course, we welcome your comments as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org, also on our webpage or Facebook page, or you can tweet us as well. Alan Chartog is here, Professor Stephen Gottlieb and Ian Pickus. You're listening to The Roundtable, and The Roundtable will return after the short break. Welcome back to our roundtable. On The Roundtable, we have a few minutes left and all kinds of good stuff to talk about, and we'll get to as much of it as we possibly can. We have Professor Stephen Gottlieb with us from Albany Law. We've been talking a lot about the Supreme Court this morning. We're going to continue to talk about court issues in just a moment. But we also want to welcome, of course, and if you're just joining us, know that our news director, Ian Pickus, is here, as well as Dr. Alan Chartok. And we'd love to hear from you. I want to talk about this very interesting development out of North Dakota, where the governor has approved the nation's toughest abortion restrictions on Tuesday, signing into law a measure that would ban nearly all abortions and inviting a legal showdown over just how much states can limit access to the procedure. And I have to say that when I first read about this, I was surprised that this was not an issue, you know, that this hadn't come up before. In the sense of that the states would take action like this on a more regular basis.
Well, I think they keep pushing the limits back and back and back. You kind of test it. And this flies and that flies. I think the background of this that people should understand is for about the last 30 years, the court has overturned only one limitation on abortion. I may want to qualify that and say two. But the one that I was thinking of was the spousal notification. You might want to add to that the issue of the method of abortion, the so-called partial birth abortion, where when O'Connor was on the court, some of that was overturned. But otherwise, there's been a very long sequence of decisions of the court saying you can limit abortion this way, that way, the other way, and so forth. But the limitations, you know, some of them, they started, well, you have to counsel the woman and there has to be a little waiting period.
Right.
Now, those are pretty significant limitations, particularly if you're poor, you're taking off work, you're driving to another place. I mean, they can really mean that some people don't get it. But it's clearly been getting more extreme.
This is being called the heartbeat bill, and it is
a
law that forbids abortion once a fetal heartbeat is detectable, which can be detected as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. And so the governor said that the Supreme Court has never considered this precise restriction. However, he did acknowledge that although the likelihood of this measure surviving a court challenge remains in question, this bill is nevertheless a legitimate challenge by the state legislature to discover the boundaries of Roe versus Wade, which I guess obviously gets into what you were saying about.
Well, you know, Roe versus Wade really followed a very traditional road in the sense that it was about quickening, the quickening of the fetus, which is an idea that I don't know how far back it goes, but a huge length of time. But you weren't able to identify before modern medicine, you weren't able to identify that heartbeat. So what you started noticing was that the baby or fetus or whatever you want to call it moved around in the belly, and that was thought of as quickening. And then you recognized that something was happening in there, and depending upon your view of life, that's a life in utero. But now you can, you know, take a stethoscope and you can, or I don't know if it's a stethoscope or what they actually use, and you can identify that heartbeat. And so that's kind of like what I was saying before about the graphics and so forth. The more that you can trace human-like traits in the embryo, the more that people get upset about going through an abortion.
You know, I was here when New York State became the first. Are you that old? Are you as old as I am? No.
You and I are the same age.
Okay. Yeah. So I was here when the New York State Legislature passed the first abortion law.
I was in Missouri at the time. They didn't.
They didn't. allowing it. And there was this guy named Michaels, and he stood up on the floor, and he said that his kid had called him a prostitute because he was upstate New Yorker. He changed his vote very dramatically, and he announced as a result of this, he would be displaced. His party didn't even nominate him again, but he was one of the great profiles in courage of the state legislature, which goes to the point that we're discussing right now. A governor like this could be doing it because of his judicial philosophy or whatever else, but he could also be doing it because he wants votes.
Of course.
And, you know, it's sort of that simple.
Right.
And he doesn't give a damn. Whether or not, you know, judicially this thing will stand or whether it doesn't, because he stands up and he says to his core constituency, I want this. And you should vote for me.
Right.
And they've been completely open about it being a trial balloon for the court. You know, they've said they expect to have to reconstitute the bill at some point. And, you know, they've talked to the Republican Party and the legislature about that very thing. So, you know, they know 6 weeks is possibly a red flag for a lot of people going into this bill.
There are an enormous number of sort of legal they're not think tanks, I'm blanking on the word, but legal organizations that are not-for-profit organizations that are just dedicated to dealing with abortion rights, religious rights, from both sides of the spectrum on that one, and voting rights.
Well, so advocacy and lobbying,
yeah,
right?
I mean, advocacy, legal organizations.
When we should note that this is also a very similar law took hold a couple of weeks ago in Arkansas, so this is yet another state added onto that. And also one of the things I found interesting, this is the first of its kind in the nation as far as the North Dakota law, that it would prevent abortions in cases of gender preference or genetic defects like Down syndrome.
Right. And there again, there are constituencies that care about both of those issues. I think many of us kind of horrified if people choose the gender of their children. My kids didn't want to know; they just were waiting to find out when the babies arrived. Mm-hmm. But there's a certainly what do they call themselves? The challenged community. Are very concerned about eliminating children with birth defects because then they say, well, what are we? Swiss cheese or whatever the expression was. And so I think it's a clever move on the part of the abortion opponents to fix on specific things that there are a lot of us that could say, yeah, well, that's wrong.
When you obviously, I don't think it would surprise anybody. Obviously, this will. I mean, they're testing it, and mm-hmm. so how far will it go is the question. But it'll take a while.
On this court, they'll probably succeed.
Which is why I want to ask you. We only have a second here, but I wanted to ask you real quickly. Based on the fact that Obama's the president, he gets the next picks, who leaves, and what is likely to happen in the reconstitution of the court?
Well.
In other words, the Republicans have been smart. They have nominated very young people to the court, where the Democrats are the ones who are likely to lose people.
First of all, you got to understand the U.S. Supreme Court operates very differently than the New York Court of Appeals,
sure.
which is our highest court. Because in New York, they get 14-year terms and an age limit. And neither of those things is true in the federal system. Mm-hmm. So you get people like Justice Stevens who served for over three decades.
And how old was Holmes when they finally visited upon him?
90.
Yeah.
And so was Stevens.
Yeah.
As far as I know, they're our oldest formerly serving justices. So there's no particular moment when anybody has to step down. That tends to be that somebody... O'Connor stepped down to care for her husband. It turned out that it was too late. Some stepped down because they become incapable of doing the work. They all the problems of old age. Others step down because they die.
So, but what you're saying is if Obama gets a couple of more appointments, they're unlikely to change the composition of the court based on the ages of the people who are there. Am I wrong about that?
We just have about 30 seconds. I'm sorry, but
that's all right.
Time enough to pick a judge.
You're absolutely right about age, but that doesn't necessarily track health.
Sure.
And looking at body types, for example, I think there are a couple of the conservatives that might be unhealthy. But I don't know, and I'm certainly not wishing anybody's death.
Of course not.
You can, and on that note, you can always join us by emailing at roundtable@wamc.org. My great thanks to our panel, Alan, Ian, and Professor Gottlieb. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
The Roundtable continues after news. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.